is God's word. I waited patiently for the Lord. He inclined to me and heard my cry. He drew me up from the pit of destruction, out of the miry bog, and set my feet upon a rock, making my steps secure. He put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise to our God. Many will see and fear and put their trust in the Lord. Blessed is the man who makes the Lord his trust, who does not turn to the proud, to those who go astray after a lie. You have multiplied, O Lord my God, your wondrous deeds and your thoughts toward us. None can compare with you. I will proclaim and tell them, yet they're more than can be told. In sacrifice and offering you have not delighted, but you have given me an open ear. Burnt offering and sin offering you have not required. Then I said, Behold, I've come. In the scroll of the book it is written of me. I delight to do your will, O my God. Your law is within my heart. I've told the glad news of deliverance in the great congregation. Behold, I've not restrained my lips, as you know, O Lord. I've not hidden your deliverance within my heart. I've spoken of your faithfulness and your salvation. I've not concealed your steadfast love and your faithfulness from the great congregation. As for you, O Lord, you will not restrain your mercy from me. Your steadfast love and your faithfulness will ever preserve me. For evils have encompassed me beyond number. My iniquities have overtaken me, and I cannot see. They're more than the hairs of my head. My heart fails me. Be pleased, O Lord, to deliver me. O Lord, make haste to help me. Let those be put to shame and disappointed together, altogether, who seek to snatch away my life. Let those be turned back and brought to dishonor who delight in my hurt. Let those be appalled because of their shame, who say to me, Aha! Aha! But may all who seek you rejoice and be glad in you. May those who love your salvation say continually, Great is the Lord. As for me, I am poor and needy, but the Lord takes thought for me. You are my help and my deliverer. Do not delay, O my God. Thank you. Please be seated. When I was thinking about the idea of trusting, the first thing that came to my mind was our money. And I decided to do a little searching on that. And I had always been told that in God we trust was a recent thing and didn't show up on our money until the 1950s. Well, I was wrong. This motto is, you know, as you know, subject of a lot of debate between different factions in the country, but it's true that it hasn't always been on our money. But the history is kind of interesting. The Secretary of the Treasury during the Civil War, Salmon Chase, received a number of appeals, letters urging him to acknowledge God on our money. And so the first appeal came in on November 13th, 1861, from the Reverend M.R. Watkinson from Ridleyville, Pennsylvania. And this was his letter. Dear sir, you are about to submit your annual report to the Congress respecting the affairs of the national finances. I think that's pretty impressive that he knew that the Secretary of the Treasury. I would not know that. One fact touching our currency has hitherto been seriously overlooked. I mean the recognition of the Almighty God in some form on our coins. You are probably a Christian. Is that something that somebody would say to a government official that, you know, maybe you wouldn't say today? You are probably a Christian. What if our republic were not shattered beyond reconstruction? Would not the antiquaries of succeeding centuries rightly reason from our past that we were a heathen nation? So he went on to propose a specific design that I'm not going to, you know, read through because it wasn't ultimately approved. But what drove him to write was he said later in the letter, From my hearth, in other words, my fireplace house, I have felt our national shame in disowning God as not the least of our present national disasters. So it's kind of interesting that this minister believed that the tragedy of the Civil War was actually a lesser tragedy than the nation not acknowledging God. And in fact, they were linked together. But what I find is really interesting is that his letter had an immediate effect. This was the first letter that the Secretary of the Treasury had gotten about this. 1 week later, he sent an order to one of the people under him in the Treasury and charged him to create a design. Now, can you imagine? I mean, whoever would think about just writing to a government official and expecting him to just turn on a dime, pun intended, and actually respond, but he did. Now, it didn't happen overnight, but in God we trust was placed on all U.S. coins beginning around the end of the Civil War. So around 1866, I think, is when they all had it on there. It didn't expand to the paper money until the beginning of the 20th century. And then in 1957, there was an act of Congress that made that phrase the official motto of the United States. Now, we could argue whether that motto is an asset or a liability in people actually personally coming to faith and trust in Christ, but we're not going to do that this morning. But I just want to ask the question, what does it mean to trust God? Very simple. I think Psalm 40 really helps us out with that. This is one of the most well-known and well-loved psalms in the Psalter. A lot of hymns and songs throughout the history have been written based on it. And grasping what trust is really, it's essential to being a Christian. So it's really an important question for us to ask and answer. So first I want to ask the question, there's an outline in your bulletin if you want to follow along. Why can we trust God? We don't know the exact circumstances David was dealing with here. We know that this psalm was written for public worship, even though he uses a lot of really personal language. So it's kind of interesting. It's almost like a personal prayer to God, but it was actually written for the church, for the, you know, the Old Testament people. But so what that tells me is more than likely David is writing about some circumstances that everybody knew. Everybody kind of understood the situation. It was public knowledge, or he was writing broadly enough where people could relate to it. They could all apply this in some kind of a circumstance in their lives. But at the beginning of the psalm, the Hebrew is a lot more honest, more blunt than the English. He says, I waited for the Lord. He bent down to me and heard my cry. You can almost picture this idea of God and turning and bending over to listen. He drew me from the pit of destruction, out of the miry bog, and set my feet on a rock, making my steps secure. There's a really vivid illustration of this in Israel's history. Jeremiah the prophet prophesied towards the end of the southern kingdom of Judah, and he was preaching to the kings, and Zedekiah in particular was one that he had seen Babylon invade, because Babylon came in actually three waves at the end of the history of the southern people. And so Zedekiah had already seen this happen, and so he knew what happened, and he rebelled anyway. But all along, Jeremiah was preaching that Babylon was God's agent of judgment. He was telling the people, listen, you guys are in sin. You're worshiping idols. Babylon is not the problem. You are the problem. And so he was telling them, if you want to obey God, you obey Babylon, which I'm sure you can understand went over really, really well with everybody in the kingdom. So Zedekiah got sick and tired of listening to Jeremiah, and so he threw him into a cistern, and it was used for gathering water in the wintertime. And it was this big pit dug in the earth and then covered with concrete on the inside. So it was sort of pear-shaped, at least 10 feet deep, 10 feet across. And if there'd been water in it, of course, you would have drowned, but there wasn't. But it was full of mud. And so Jeremiah literally sank most of his body, into this mud, this miry bog, the bottom of this pit. And he would have died there if it wasn't for an official from Babylon who, when they actually did break down the walls and come in the city, they look at Jeremiah in the pit and figured, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And so they pulled him out and saved his life. But Jeremiah is, you know, so he lived out this whole idea. David is talking picture-wise, metaphorically, about this idea. And so he went through a lot of different circumstances in his life. He was in a pit of fear, you could say, running from King Saul as a young man. He was later in the pit of his own sin when he committed adultery with Bathsheba. And we'll talk in more detail about that later. But he knew what it was like to sink like a pit in life circumstances. But in both cases, God had rescued him from those pits and restored him. And you see, you probably know this, David was a singer, he was a musician, and he loved to tell his life story, the good and the bad, in song. And so you could say that his life song, his life story, was one of being rescued by God. Now, if you're a Christian, you've experienced the same thing, haven't you? We have been rescued from the effects of our sin. Now, I want you to think for a minute, think about your story of how God changed you. You know, maybe you became a Christian as a young child. Maybe you became a Christian as a teenager, as a college student. I want you to think about what direction your life would have taken if you had not become a Christian. Just imagine. You know the road you were heading down. And you know how radically God changed your direction. Now, for some of you, maybe it wasn't a real radical change. But maybe it was. Think about where you might have ended up if it hadn't been for him. Because your decisions changed, didn't they? Your lifestyle changed. Your habits, the people you hung around with. All of that changed. Where would you be today? You see, our destiny apart from a relationship with God through Christ is not only the physical grave, it is an eternity separated from God. So when we trust in Jesus, we are rescued from that. And so David tells us that when other people see that, when they see our lives have been changed, they're affected too. Now he uses the word see and fear. And in Hebrew, see and fear sound almost identical. It creates kind of a play on words. If you see God's work in somebody's life, if you really see it, not just with your eyes, your physical eyes, but if you actually take that in, then that itself is to fear. If you truly see, you will fear God because you know it's real. You know that this person's life has changed. They were like this, and now they're not. Now look at verse 4 with me. He says, "Blessed is the man who makes the Lord his trust, who does not turn to the proud, to those who go astray after a lie. You've multiplied, O Lord, my God, your wondrous deeds and your thoughts toward us. None can compare with you. I will proclaim and tell of them, yet they're more than can be told." So we can trust God because in our own lives he's rescued us. If you're not a Christian, he can rescue you. Now, if you're not a Christian, you may not really think you need to be rescued. You might think a bunch of people sitting in pink, are they pink? I guess they're pink chairs, you know, in a room like this, talking about being rescued is a little odd. And that's understandable why you might think that. But you see, you have to see the seriousness of your sin in order to grasp what it means to be rescued from it. And until God makes you see that, it's absolute foolishness. It's just idiocy until you see that, until God opens your eyes. In verses 4 and 5, David gets broader than just his own story. And he talks about people in general who trust in God. He says they're blessed, they're favored. The NIV says, "Blessed is the one whose trust is in the Lord, who does not look to the proud, to those who turn aside to false gods." And the word that David uses for proud, it's a word in Hebrew that became the nickname for Egypt, the empty blusterer, which I think is just the greatest word, the greatest name, the empty blusterer. Now, why would Egypt be called the empty blusterer? Well, you know, if you look at the story of the Exodus, how all of their gods were basically made to look stupid by God through all of the plagues. Every one of the plagues was targeted to a particular god in Egypt. So I was thinking about this idea that he says, to those who turn aside to false gods, and he says, the proud, those who turn aside to false gods. It struck me that idolatry, worshiping other gods other than the true God, is essentially self-worship. And that's why idolatry at its heart is pride, because if you think about it, any other god, any other religious system, every other religious system is essentially it's rooted in works. It's rooted in self-achievement. I've got to do this in order to make the God happy with me. And so what else does that lead to but pride? If I'm the one who's making it happen, if I'm the one that's actually saving myself, that pride is the natural consequence of that. Now, you know, some of you might say, well, you know, Christians are pretty good at pride. Yes, we are. But pride is antithetical to the Christian message. Every other religious system, it is built into the foundation. So David is saying he delights in telling other people the great things that God has done for him. He loses count, there's so many. So he's saying that the heart of his belief system is his need of God. It is dependence. We need to need. I know that sounds kind of weird, the way it comes out. Well, let me explain it with the opposite. You know what it means to need to be needed, right? If you need to be needed, you know, say a friend or a child or a coworker or a family member, you know, they need help and you can kind of come in and you can help them and you can help them make decisions or you can, you know, we feel a need to be needed. We need to be helping people. It makes us feel validated. It makes us feel important. It makes us feel like we matter. Now, it's not the healthiest thing in the world, right? Because if you derive your sense of worth, your sense of identity from helping somebody else, then you're going to help them maybe too much. Maybe you're going to enable them. Maybe you need to back off and let them struggle a little bit. So to need to be needed is not always the best thing. But what David here is saying is that we need to need. We need to need God, ultimately. Otherwise, we're going to run after the idol of self-worship. The other day, I had lunch with our pastor in Nashua, Jason Wakefield, and another pastor from Virginia who we're hoping will come and do an evangelism workshop for the presbytery in the future. His name is Alan Dayhoff, and he's the pastor of Grace Fellowship Church in, I think it's Fairfax County, Virginia. So he was talking about the workshop, and what impressed me about Al was not what he said about the workshop. What impressed me about him was how he put it into practice, because out of the 80 minutes that we spent talking and having lunch, 30 minutes of it we were talking to the server, the waitress. And how in the world she actually got the food to all the other tables she was serving, I have no idea, but somehow she did, because they didn't, like, fire her, come over and yell at her. But we were just talking back and forth over and over and over. And Al was the one that got it started. He just made the atmosphere conducive to her talking. Now, this woman, it was unusually open in terms of sharing her story. But it was really, really, really impressive. But what I wanted to share with you was we had this conversation about tattoos, because Al is writing a book called God and it's about God and tattoos. So he's convinced that tattoos are, people get tattoos for spiritual reasons. And although Jessica disagreed with him on some of that, that was kind of interesting. They had this little back and forth. But one of the things, the thing that was fascinating was she basically told us her life story sitting right there. And then after that, he told her that he was a pastor and that we were pastors too. And then she turns about three shades of purple and says, "Oh my God, what did I say?" It's really funny. But we were talking about tattoos, and one of the things that struck me was that Jessica said that most men use tattoos to show their strength, their machismo. Men want to portray an image. So in effect, what she was saying was that men use tattoos for self-protection. You know, they want you to see this certain image of them. So it's almost like armor, because they don't want you to see the vulnerabilities. But she said women, now this is a generalization, okay? There's always exceptions to every rule, so I'm sure you can think of at least five people who are different. But this is sort of the general rule. Women, she said, use tattoos for self-revelation. In other words, they put in a tattoo something that has deep meaning, that is a key almost, that unlocks a little part of their hearts. And they want people to see that because it's very special. It might be painful. It might be hurtful. It might be something or someone they're really proud of. It might be someone that they show the feel great affection for, or someone that has been hurt that they sort of feel an affinity for. But it was fascinating because it showed me in that conversation why generally it takes a lot more time for a man to embrace the Christian faith than it does for a woman. Because the Christian faith requires what? Dependence, need, weakness. And for men, those are not normal things that we want to be associated with. We want to be strong. We want to be self-sufficient. At least we want people to think we are. But if we're going to trust God, we need to need him. So that's why we can trust God. Okay, how do we trust him? Verse 6, David says, "In sacrifice and offering you have not delighted, but you've given me an open ear. Burnt offering and sin offering you have not required." You may remember the story of Samuel and King Saul in Israel. This was before King David. But Samuel said something very much like this to King Saul, because King Saul was waiting for Samuel to get there to offer a sacrifice, and he was impatient, and he was afraid he was going to lose you know, lose the people. And so he went ahead and did it. And so he said to Samuel, no, I had to offer the sacrifice. You were late. Where were you? And Samuel said, essentially, God doesn't want your sacrifice. That's not what is most important. It is a heart of obedience to him. So when David says, my ears you have opened, he uses this word for dig. And all I can think of is like earwax. Sorry, that's the image that comes to my mind. But that's not what he's talking about. The Hebrew is tricky here, but it seems that God is preparing David for something important. He says, then I said, behold, I have come. In the scroll of the book it is written of me. I delight to do your will, O my God. Your law is within my heart. Now, if you think about David, this is true of him. David was prophesied earlier in the Old Testament. David did come to reign. He did delight most of the time in God's law. But the full meaning of that part of the psalm does not become clear until the New Testament. Now turn to Hebrews chapter 10 with me. And we're going to see how this is fulfilled. If you don't have a Bible, just listen along. Hebrews chapter 10, beginning in verse 4. Hebrews 10:4 says, for it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. Consequently, when Christ came into the world, he said, sacrifices and offerings you have not desired, but a body you have prepared for me. In burnt offerings and sin offerings you have taken no pleasure. Then I said, behold, I have come to do your will, O God, as it is written of me in the scroll of the book. So you see what the writer of Hebrews is doing with Psalm 40. He's taking David's psalm. Now, he's using a different translation. It's the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament. Slightly different. It was written in the 2nd century B.C. But he's quoting this psalm, and he's ascribing the words to Jesus. And so they're true of David, but they're fulfilled much more fully in Jesus' life and death on the cross. Jesus didn't just delight in God's law, right? He kept it perfectly. Burnt offerings were no longer required. Why? Because of Jesus' once-for-all sacrifice. The Old Testament spoke of David, but infinitely more of Jesus. So we realize this psalm doesn't just tell us about David being rescued. It actually speaks the words of the rescuer, Jesus. So how do we trust God? He tells us, we dedicate ourselves to God through Christ. God doesn't primarily want our religious actions, our worship, you know, on Sunday morning. He wants our lives in devotion to Jesus Christ, who fulfilled every religious action in his obedience to the Father. And so what we do on Sunday morning, which, yes, we should do, it's a great thing, what we do on Sunday morning has meaning because of what Jesus did. And David goes on then to talk about his response. He can't stop telling God's people about what God did for him. And so a part of trusting God is to tell people in the church about it, God's people about it. If God has changed your heart, you have a testimony to share. And if you have a testimony to share, then by all means, share it. Don't keep it to yourself. You never know how God is going to use your story in somebody else's life. Some element of it that you maybe never even thought about. Now, obviously, we are called to share our stories with people outside the church. But if we can't do it inside the church, guess what? We're probably not going to do it outside the church. So let's start here. And I'll do a shameless plug. Okay. This fall, we're talking in the session about our men's breakfast on Saturday mornings, on the second Saturday. So our theme is this idea of God's working in our individual stories. Our theme for the year is tell the good news, share the good news. So we thought in the men's breakfast, each month we're going to have one of the guys share their testimony, just share how God has worked in their lives. And we're going to pray for the people in our spheres of influence. And I learned when Chris was here the other Sunday, which I didn't get to hear that sermon because somehow I didn't get the recording, but Chris was sharing that you should pray for, I think it was three people, three times a day, right? And what he didn't know was that I had, at the beginning of this year, in January, I had charged you all to pick five people and pray for them on a regular basis that don't know the Lord. And so that's kind of neat, I think, how this was reinforced unknowingly. So let's take that to heart. But I'm just telling you men, sorry ladies, but you can find some other way to do that. But that's one way that we're going to do it, and just to watch to see how God uses our stories impacting other people. All right, the last thing I want you to see here is when who we trust matters the most. When who we trust matters the most. Up to this point, the flow of the psalm makes sense. You know, David shares how God delivered him from trouble. He gives us reasons for trusting God. And then he talks about what does it look like to trust God. You know, you share that with other people. But then after that, when you get to verse 11, it seems to almost go backwards. And he ends the psalm talking about trouble again. And you want to say to David, hey, David, you know, newsflash, we already talked about this. Why do you want to bring it up again? But there's a reason he does this. There is no storybook ending to this psalm. You know, Hollywood wouldn't write a movie about this aspect of David's life because they would want it to end with him as a conquering hero, triumphantly. But that's not how David's story ended, is it? He had a lot of struggles at the end of his life. You know, that's why when you watch a movie, and you what do you say yourself as the credits are ending? This is not real life. This is just a movie. Because it's not real. But you see, David's life was real, and so was yours. And it doesn't wrap up into a nice, neat little package. And that's actually a good thing. So David's trouble continued. He says, for evils beyond number have surrounded me. My iniquities have overtaken me so that I'm not able to see. They're more numerous than the hairs of my head, and my heart has failed me. Now, again, we don't know the specific context. I'm going to step out on a limb and make a speculation here. It sounds to me very much like the fallout that happened in David's life and his family from his sin with Bathsheba. Okay, a little brief history. His son Amnon raped his half-sister Tamar. His son Absalom murdered his half-brother Amnon. Absalom was later exiled. He was then allowed to come back and return. He leads a rebellion against David, boots David off the throne. David is actually exiled briefly because of Absalom's rebellion. Absalom then sleeps with all of his concubines and disgraces himself and his father's family. Absalom is later killed in the battle, the war that results from that. And so you think about it, David's one night of passion had wide-ranging, painful effects for the rest of his life. At the same time, though, David prayed desperately for God to deliver him from his enemies. He says, let those be put to shame and disappointed altogether who seek to snatch away my life. Let those be turned back and brought to dishonor who delight in my hurt. Let those be appalled because of their shame who say to me, aha, aha. I know that sounds really strange to us today. But essentially what David's saying is those who say, yes, this is our chance to bring him down. That's what he's saying. Now, we experience this too, don't we? At all kinds of different levels. Our sin affects not only us. Our sin affects our families. It affects others around us. It affects our children. And even if the trouble you're going through right now is not your fault, even if it's not directly or indirectly related to your sin, it doesn't go away. You may have gone through a major health crisis, and then a year later, you're in a financial crisis. And then maybe a year after that, your family seems to be falling apart. And you know, do you ever say to yourself, could I just catch a break, Lord? You know, could we have a peaceful season? Sometimes God doesn't choose to do that. But no matter who we are, we all experience this at some level, some worse than others. But trouble is not going to go away in this life. It's just not. And we talked about this last week. We have this idea in our society, feel-goodism, that somehow my life should be smooth. And if it's not smooth, I should be able to take a pill to make it at least feel smooth. And that's a problem. We learned last week that it is contributing to our psychic decline, whatever that means. But that doesn't work. This idea that my life should be smooth or I should at least want it to feel smooth, it doesn't work in a fallen world. This is when who we trust matters the most. Self-worship doesn't cut it. Achieving by my works it's not the answer. And this is where the Christian message really shines in the darkest places. And I'm convinced this is why the Christian faith is spreading like wildfire in the two-thirds world, in the undeveloped, in the underdeveloped world. And it's stagnating in the developed, Western, wealthy countries. Why? Because we have lots of other little gods in little orange containers with white caps and labels. We have all kinds of other things to make us feel meaningful. But in the rest of the world, there often is nothing else. And they cling to what is true. And the one thing that we need too. When we read this section, which, by the way, this is a little, you know, just a trivia thing. Psalm 70 is actually almost identical to the last part of Psalm 40. But when we read this section, in light of Jesus' death on the cross, it brings God's purpose into focus. If you could read that last section and just read it from the perspective of Jesus. Evil surrounded Jesus on the cross. His sins overtook him, but they weren't his sins, they were my sins. They weighed him down to the point that his heart was breaking. And Jesus cried out for deliverance, but he didn't cry out for the destruction of his enemies. He cried out for their forgiveness. You see, there's a key difference between David and Jesus here. Not that David was wrong to ask for deliverance. David's enemies deserve judgment. But what we've got to remember here is that David was God's enemy too. David and every human being outside of God's grace is God's enemy. We all deserve destruction. And it was Jesus Christ hanging on that cross that made it possible for God's enemies to become his children. That's why the consequences of our sin don't have to and will not ultimately overtake us. They have been paid by the shedding of Jesus' blood. And that's why the circumstances that we're struggling with are not ultimately going to take us down. And Jesus' suffering has overcome the world. And even if the difficulty we're going through takes our lives, we will ultimately be delivered from the pit of death. You see, our brothers and sisters in Iraq and Syria who are dying at the hands of ISIS by the hundreds and thousands, they can claim these words of promise from God. Even though they are dying unjustly, you are my help and my deliverer. Do not delay, O Lord my God. You know what? God in his sovereign wisdom sometimes does delay, doesn't he? Sometimes he does not prevent evil from taking the lives of his children. And I don't know why that is. I don't understand it, but I know that God in his wisdom has a reason. But even those children of his who have lost their lives because of the glory of his name will say, as David said, "The Lord be magnified." And they will say that because Jesus Christ, who also, by the way, his prayer was not answered. Right? Jesus asked to be delivered, and he was not. But the reason that even if our death overtakes us, the reason that it will not ultimately overtake us is because of Jesus' resurrection. He conquered sin and death. Trust your death to the one who endured death for you. Because you will not be disappointed. It's just like the words of Ann Steele from that song that we sang. That last verse. "Hear, O my soul, thy trust repose. If Jesus is forever mine, not death itself, that last of foes, shall break a union so divine." Jesus conquered sin and death for us. Aren't you glad? Father in heaven, we thank you that you have delivered us. You have set us on a rock. You've delivered us from the mud and the mire, the difficulties that we've gone through. But like David, we are still going through them. And in this life, we're not going to see the end of it. But that does not have to leave us in despair. Because Christ has conquered sin and death, we can have hope. In fact, we of all people have the most hope of all. Lord, please inflame our hearts with this. Help us to realize that this is more important than everything else that surrounds us, that wants to dull our senses to the importance of the gospel. And Lord, please build your kingdom through us. We pray this in Christ's name. Amen.